Hey, this is Ricky Herbst, cinema program director, coming to you live, or at least live-ish, from the state-of-the-art Browning Cinema in the lovely DeBartolo Performing Arts Center on the bucolic campus of the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, St. Joe County, Indiana. Thank you for listening. Today, I'm joined, as always, by Kevin Krzmanich, who heads up the technology that makes the Browning Cinema tick, as well as the sound engineering on these lectures, as well as the Establishing Shot podcast, the official podcast of the Browning Cinema. As always, big thanks to Kevin, and also to Stacey Stigovich, who makes this available to you online on the fancy-schmancy new DeBartolo Performing Arts website she and our marketing department just rolled out. Get ready to pat yourself on the back, because you have reason to do so. We're at week 6 and closing out not only the midway point of the semester's class, but also the 6 modes of documentary Bill Nichols created. I think it is incredibly important, and media literacy studies back this up, that we have an instant framework we apply when we watch something, be it a film or online video or whatnot. Why is that? If we have that first recognition of this thing is this kind of thing, then there is, at a basic level, some distance and recognition of what we're seeing. There is reflexivity, as we talked about last week, between us, the viewers, and the media we are engaging. And that's generally in short supply when people watch documentaries. The genre of reality stays clumped together when it needn't be, which keeps some of that reflexivity at bay. Further, I think it limits our imagination to keep the genre in one pile. When we watch a film like Central Park 5, now we can think, how else could this story be told? What would it look like in poetic form, like Samsara, where we reassemble images of the topic poetically? Could you do that and not lack too much specificity or be too abstract? Or in an observational form, like in the studio scenes in Buena Vista Social Club, where we dodge commentary and reenactment and instead observe the world as it unfolds in front of the invisible camera? Could you do that and not lose a sense of history and context? In participatory form, like Greg Gardens, where interviews and interactions with subjects is key, and that's actually a component of Central Park 5, and so not that hard to imagine, or in the reflexive mode, like Grizzly Man, where the form of documentary, what the properties of the medium and genre are called into question and undermines the sense of absorption and reality other documentaries offer us. Could you do that without losing sight of the core issues presented in the case or without being too abstract? Or, in the performative mode we're going to be seeing this week in Michael Moore's Roger and Me. And that's an excellent thought experiment whenever you're watching a news story or a documentary on Netflix or any film, really, that process of imagining how else this could have been done, how else could this picture have been painted, how could you have gone about making this film yourself, either replicating it or retelling it. Those are wonderful ways, I think at least, to engage art in documentaries, in particular as a way to create your own moments of the alienation effect Brecht described. To make you an active viewer, to make you a powerful viewer, that's one way to go about it. For those reasons, I really do champion the idea of documentary modes, which I recognize are quite messy, but seeing how particular elements from each mode find their ways into films or how they could be utilized in films, I think will make us better readers of reality and, in turn, better people. I really do think it's that big. So, last but not least, what is the performative mode? The notion here is that the subjective experiences are winding throughout a film and the audience, so these films look to embrace that subjectivity. Its closest cousin of the modes, I would say, is the poetic one, as it doesn't really look to make you feel like you comprehend the totality of the system. It isn't pushing you toward expertise or facts. The personal experience and its subjectivity is embraced, are embraced, offering it to the audience. Will the audience react to those experiences the same way? Performative mode doesn't really get wound up in that, although still has arguments like poetic documentaries baked into them. It's much more about the act of self-articulation, whether that self is a particular society, class, subculture, or individual. Nichols says that performative documentaries' history of, quote, social subjectivity is often that of the underrepresented or misrepresented of women and ethnic minorities, gays and lesbians. Performative documentary can act as a corrective to those films where we speak about them to us. They proclaim instead that we speak about ourselves to you, or we speak about ourselves to us, end quote. I really like that idea, so let's run it one more time. Think of how many films, especially in the dominant mode of expository films, where people are explained by an off-camera voice. Here, this is a person going to vote. Here, this is a person looking for a job. Think of the nightly news. People speak about them to us in an address that often assumes that the audience is white and middle class and educated and, this is important, caring. They speak to that audience about others so that the audience can say, oh, I know those folks. I know that situation. I get what they're all about. Performative's check on that is to have that articulation be internal. The people with skin in the game are calling the shots. I'll describe myself the way I want. They get to say it how they want. You, the audience, may not be in on the in-joke. You may not get the lingo unless you happen to know it prior. Some performative films, like Paris is Burning about gay ball culture, are more didactic in bringing you the language and into the scene. There's actually big title cards that read ball lingo like throwing shade, which worked its way into cultural parlance. But that teaching is not a requirement. We're the subject's guests in these films, and they are not required to hand out drinks, but they can do so if they please. Rather than being grounded in some facts, these films want to talk to us through emotion and expression. You can see how the filmmaker's personality can come through in films like these, which is why I think you see more playfulness and comedy in performative documentaries. Performative docs don't need to be sober, even if the effect they provide is sobering. That position makes realism, like in the reflexive mode, less important for performative documentaries. As Nichols says, the referential quality of documentary that attests to its function as a window onto the world yields to an expressive quality that affirms the highly situated, embodied, vividly personal perspective of specific subjects, including the filmmaker, unquote. Sure, there may be real elements or episodes that a person experiences, but the need to filter and present objective data isn't important in the least. The narrative structures, while not as loose as those in poetic docs, have a liberty to them as well, in part because the role of the filmmaker and subjects are so experiential and not built for some of the story arcs we have seen in other films. That doesn't mean performative docs lack structure. Michael Moore films certainly have their own cadence that pretty much follows all of his films. But they are not bound to do the textbook model of, now I will teach you something, even if they do teach you something. So what about Roger and Me, this week's film? How does that fit into the mix? Again, working from Nichols' words that, quote, performative documentary restores a sense of magnitude to the local, specific, and embodied. It animates the person so that many become our port of entry to the political, unquote. That right there encapsulates Roger and Me incredibly, incredibly well. I have to think Nichols was thinking of Roger and Me when he wrote it. Roger and Me uses the stories of a local community, Flint, Michigan, as a port of entry into the failings of corporate greed and the deterioration of the working class. As such, it isn't only about inviting us into the community, It is about inviting beat-down working-class individuals to speak for themselves while also allowing the upper class to speak for themselves in a way that gives them ample rope to hang themselves. Further, Michael Moore's role in the film as a character, as a subject, lends itself to the subjectivity. The film starts with Moore's personal history in Flint, footage of him as someone watching Flint grow. We can't experience those moments, and Moore understands how the past is trapped in a cloche, so he uses stock footage from the time to fill in his experiences. And all of this is presented with a self-deprecating style and earnest comedy, despite the seriousness of the subject material, that being the death of an American city at the hands of corporate greed. In some ways, one could see giving the swings of laughter to tears as mapping alongside the growth and fall of Flint. And Moore is very wise to understand how humor and absurdity and satire can be used to expose truth despite the subjective nature of humor and absurdity and satire. Moore paints a picture of Flint we can all understand by the end of the film in our own distinct ways. Now, here's an interesting thread. Moore was often attacked after the film's success, and you have to understand this film was a phenomenon. It came from nowhere and was made by a nobody in the field before becoming a giant success, selling to Warner Brothers for $3 million and landing on a slew of top 10 lists for 1989. What came along with that success was a great deal of scrutiny. The central question, was Roger and Me truthful? In the film, multiple events from prior to GM moving plants to Mexico are presented, potentially, as if they happened after the corporate exodus and ensuing job loss. Along with other peccadilloes, does that mean the film isn't truthful? People got hung up on this question. Roger and Me was a documentary, they said, and therefore had to get everything correct. In the world of performative documentary, though, you can see how that question opens up. Was Moore getting to the truth of corporate greed and the impact it had on a city and its people over a period of time? Further, does that question really matter if he was able to evoke, through a mutated semblance of reality, the emotions in an audience for which he strove? Is Roger and Me truthful if, at its core, it reflects what the filmmaker sees in the world and wants you to see as well? I think those questions are fit perfectly for audience discussion, so I won't tip my hand on the feelings too much, but I do think we get some good insight from Michael Moore discussing Roger and Me. I'll run a sequence here quickly from an interview with a journalist who opposed Moore's style. Journalist, what happens when one manipulates sequence and that's the core credibility of the documentary? Moore's answer, and I won't do an impression, but you can hear his voice and tone if you've seen one of his movies. Moore's answer, all art, listen, every piece of journalism manipulates sequence and things. Just the fact that you edit, that certain things get taken out or put back in. You are trying to hold me to a different standard than you would another film, as if I were writing some kind of college essay. Journalists, no, I hold you to documentary film standards. Moore, because you see this primarily as a documentary. Journalist, it's not in any category I know as fiction. Moore, it's not fiction. But what if we say it's a documentary told with a narrative style? I tried to tell a documentary in a way they don't usually get told. The reason why people don't watch documentaries is that they are so bogged down with now in 1980, then in 1982, this happened, then in 84, this happened. Journalist, I'm not against documentaries not having a bias. They don't have to remain objective. Moore, we are not talking about objectivity. We are talking about a style that you seem to not like. End scene. I do like how in the article they call the film a Marx Brothers film, those Marx Brothers being Groucho and Carl. I'm going to steal that for sure. But in this interview, you can see how Moore is being called to task for his adoption of the performative mode, straddling subjective or fictive elements with the truth. Discombobulates many audiences, especially if they think from the paradigm that a documentary is the truth. It is sober evidence. It is a security camera. It is an encyclopedia. Because those same audiences couldn't place the film in a more traditional fiction or narrative world, that limbo space made people angry. And perhaps that anger is exactly what Moore wanted to pull out as well. With that, we'll say adieu to you. Big thanks again to Kevin Krismanich and Stacey Stickfitch. And see you Wednesday for Roger and me and all of you.